Welcome to episode 243 of the McSauce Comic Book Podcast. My name is Paul McGinty. With me, as always, are Ian the Sauce Sharpley.
Hello.
And Matt Cassell.
Hello.
It is Monday night, June 18th, and tonight we're going to get into the fresh, hot off the presses Chris Hardwick debacle, a subject that we don't normally cover on the show. And then we're going to do a new segment called What You Been Doing.
A spinoff of What You Been Reading, because we haven't been reading a ton, but we've been doing some stuff.
Some of us have been reading, some of us have been watching things. We're gonna spin this out into a wide open What You Been Doing. Getting new car batteries, perhaps. But before we get into the meat and potatoes of the show, we do housekeeping with Ian Sharpley.
McSauce.com, home of our comic strips, our reviews, and the lovely podcast that you're listening to right now. The main way that you can interact with us is on all the social media platforms. If you go to Facebook, type in MCSOSS, you can find our fan page where we update you when we release the podcast. You can go to Instagram and see some behind the scenes stuff. Generally just Paul having a shot or two, hanging out, socializing. That's what the Instagram.
There's a good chance you're going to see Matt and Ian's matching shorts later this evening.
Yeah, yeah, we do. We are wearing matching shorts today.
They're just gray. I mean, they.
But they have the same texture and pockets.
No, they don't.
And they have a similar texture.
They're
dude.
Both cargos. They've got similar texture, similar
Every
color.
Every summer not the same short brand. Is a cargo no. short a- no. anymore.
The texture is, I think, key.
Okay.
So go to Instagram where you can find Matt and Ian's texture short debate. And you can also find us on Twitter where we post different stuff on Twitter. You can react to the McSauce Twitter page. One thing that is exciting recently, some of you may know, some of you may own McSauce merchandise. We've had t-shirts for quite a few years, but the fans have always been asking, unite the three McSauce heads on a t-shirt. And since we treat Matt poorly, we've said no for several years. But finally, at last, all three lovely McSauce heads that you listen to each and every week have been lovingly put on a t-shirt. So if you go to tpublic.com and type in MCSOSS, that's the magic of having a nonsense name that nothing else shares the name with. You can pull up our new design of Paul, Matt, and myself with our lovely, lovely stylized heads on a t-shirt. And you can get it in a variety of styles and colors. You can get a pink baseball tee if you want. You can get a McSauce hoodie if you like. All different kinds of things are offered by Tee Public.
I recommend the tri-blend. It's a little more expensive, but god damn it, is it worth it?
How much more is it?
I think the regular they're $20. This one's $29.
Okay.
Worth every one of those $9.
You're paying for the style, splurge for the comfort.
I got my Case in Point podcast shirt in the tri-blend. It is instantly one of the most comfortable shirts I own.
I'm pretty excited about all these different colors that you can get. So I don't know. Maybe I'll get a couple different McSauce colors and wear them around
one
town.
One for each season?
Yeah, there's a orange Halloween one that I think that we should all get.
Is the graphic always white?
The graphic is always white. So I would recommend against getting the all-white t-shirt.
But there is a light gray that I think looks pretty neat with the white on it.
The white on white. I like that.
Yeah, it kind of looks kind of cool.
Yeah, you can do that. You can do that if you're styling. But yeah, lots of different colors.
I am.
Lots of different styles. I really like baseball tees, so maybe I'll get one of those.
I'd say Matt's the most styling of the three of us.
I would say so as well.
Aw, thanks.
You could get a McSauce onesie if you have tykes at home. You could get a McSauce phone case if you have a phone with you. You can also get a fancy schmancy McSauce sticker or mug. So, I mean, go crazy. Don't limit yourself to these t-shirts. Put the design, use it on anything. Just go nuts. Have a Mixos pillow.
What else are you going to get, Ian?
I don't know, man.
You'll get a mug?
I'm in need of a phone case, so maybe I'll get a Mixos phone case and just be a complete egomaniac.
That would be awesome.
It would be crazy. But, I don't know, pretty cool. I'm right in the center of all this shit, so yeah, man. Maybe I'll do that.
Are there
Maybe
hats?
I'll get one of each.
Are there hats?
I don't think
so. It doesn't look like there's hats. There's a tote, a pillow, a mug, a notebook.
A tote? What's a tote? Like just a bag?
Yeah. Wall art, sticker, laptop case, phone case, onesie. Hey, go to Tee Public and find out for yourself. Mixos casters.
Stock up, everybody. Ian, great job with housekeeping tonight.
Oh, thank you.
So over the weekend, Chris Hardwick's life got turned upside down because an ex-girlfriend of his put an article. She didn't name names in the article. She just referred to him as her ex. Used some, he and whatnot. Never called him by name, but it was clear enough that you could put the pieces together and figure out who it was. And I guess Chloe Dykstra had some traumatic experiences with Chris Hardwick. So I guess it seemed to me that this is such a sensitive subject, and being a straight white guy in 2018, like, I feel like I can't speak on it, but I do have opinions on it.
You can talk about whatever you're feeling. Like, say what you think, man. Like,
I don't think the offenses that she wrote about in her article were to the same level of other offenses we've heard over the last couple of years that have cost men their careers.
Yes, I agree. I don't think that these are similar. They're similar just because in the way that somebody's voicing their voicing what happened to them and something similar happened to the offender, being Chris Hardwick. But I don't think that you can say that Chris Hardwick's what he did is the same as Harvey Weinstein or Kevin Spacey. They aren't the same thing.
Right. It seems there was a lot of emotional abuse, which isn't right. And like, by all means, like, Chris Hardwick is a fucking dick. I've always liked Chris Hardwick. Like, I watch both Talking Dead shows. I really like the first season of Talking with Chris Hardwick, which was pulled. I never listened to Nerdist. But yeah, he always seemed like a real genial and fun guy. But once I read this article, and she points out that he was kind of like celebrity hungry, and only certain people mattered, and all of his like real friends were pushed to the side for the limelight and hanging out with celebrities. And after watching a handful of the shows that he was on, I'm like, yeah, that I get that. I can totally understand that. But the way he treated Chloe Dykstra, also reprehensible.
Yeah, there's nothing in the story that I look at and I'm like, that doesn't seem to ring true. It all seems like things that happened and to his personality. The only thing what I would say to this is that it just seems like he's a massive asshole. He's a terrible person and not somebody that you would want to be in a relationship with. Now, is he like it's not on the same level as like Weinstein or Kevin Spacey or someone like that, where it didn't seem like it was that kind of thing. It was mostly emotional abuse,
the big difference between all of the heavy hitters of the last couple of years, like Harvey Weinstein and Kevin Spacey and Bill Cosby, like they are the victims were unwilling participants. Not that Chloe Dykstra was a willing participant, but she did date him willingly. And
even after red flags at the beginning of their relationship,
yeah, like,
were
like,
thrown up, it sounds like he was a weird fucking creep that, I don't know, not to victim blame, but she likely should have seen that he was being strange, and those strange things don't go away. They only intensify. So,
yeah, she says that 2 weeks into the relationship, like, he pulled some weird stuff, like, she shouldn't go anywhere at night. Her nights are only for him. She had to take down all pictures of any other male friends in her apartment. Like,
that's a flashing red light to get,
like,
the fuck out.
I don't
of
know.
There.
I don't know what. Yeah, like, I'm not. I've never been in her shoes. Like, I'm a very alpha person myself. Like, very rarely am I ever second fiddle or submissive to anybody. So, like, reading this story and, like, trying to understand her headspace and even his headspace is, it's kind of hard for me to wrap my head around, because I see that part of the story where, like, two weeks in, he's like, you can't do this anymore. Like, well, that's, you should be out. Like, that's so fucking weird. Like, why aren't you out of that situation immediately? If he's pulling some, like, crazy dictatorial, like, you're not allowed to be on your phone, you're not allowed to talk in public, you know, you can't have male guys pictures up in your house. That's crazy shit. Like, I don't, like, I don't,
could
I
they
want
to have male dogs or male.
She wasn't 100% clear on any of that.
And, like, I 100% believe that all of this stuff happened. I saw a lot of stuff.
Oh, me too. 100%.
I saw a lot of stuff on Twitter where, like, people were coming to her defense saying things like, of course, you know, Chris Hardwick fans are going to think that this stuff didn't happen. And, like, I am a Chris Hardwick fan, but I also believe all of this stuff happened. Like, I don't think there's one bit of false information in that essay.
Yeah.
But I think it was just a really bad relationship. I think Chris Hardwick is a fucking dick. Like, the worst boyfriend. Because I mean, this is extreme, but if he was physically abusing her, like, if he was beating her, like, that's a bigger, more pronounced flag for her to get out. Like, he was,
and I think that's a different line to cross than to tell someone you can't do something.
Yeah,
because there's a part of it where that person has to then comply to what you're saying.
His emotional,
if you're physically beating someone, I think that's different.
Right. His emotional manipulation seemed to be so much more thought out and so much more underhanded that it does cause less flags for getting out. But I think some of those early flags, especially only like a couple weeks in, like, you should get out.
Yeah.
And by no means, like, do I think any of the horrible things that happened or should have happened, like, after that, but, like, it doesn't seem like there was, I don't know, she doesn't lay out a good case in that article for why she stayed. She does a little bit. She says, you know, she just kept thinking he kept giving her enough water to sustain her. Like, she kept finding enough of something good in there to keep her around. But all the bad seems so bad that, like, I mean, I don't.
And I guess in a way, if you're in it, you, like, it is like that, and you can't speak to it. And if you're in love with somebody, it makes you do those things and stay in that relationship and believe in the things that person will get, that will change themselves and get better and treat you more fairly. But it's a weird situation, and I don't get behind the people that are calling her out as a liar or saying that she did this to get some kind of level of fame. I'm sure that this girl is getting a bunch of death threats right now as we speak. So I'm sure that this definitely took a lot for her to put it out there and say this. It just seems strange to do it in the way that it happened. And
well, like there's with a lot of the other the other scandalous cases that have come out against men in Hollywood. It's, you know, it's with the purpose of this happened to me, so this can't happen to somebody else.
Yeah.
Like this is reprehensible behavior that needs to be stopped. So Harvey Weinstein can't do this to somebody else.
But how
so
are you
Kevin Spacey
stop
can't
this
do this
bad
to someone else. But right, but
and
this isn't
relationships. You can't.
But yeah, but this isn't something like that. Chris Hardwick's transgressions aren't I need to speak up so that no one does this again. Can you be tried for just being a complete asshole? He seems to have a pretty good relationship with his current wife. They've been together for 2 years. I don't know, maybe by the middle of this week, she's coming out like, oh yeah, he's the absolute worst. And but again, like, if it's the same things, it's not, like, I don't know how this doesn't, like, stop an epidemic of female abuse.
Yeah,
maybe it does.
Yeah, I guess they're. I'm thinking to myself. I don't know what the end game is to it, but maybe that there isn't an. Maybe there isn't an end game. Maybe this is just for her personal peace of mind, and a way for her to gain closure in the situation. Maybe that's all it is, and maybe there isn't a bigger scale to it or a bigger answer to it. But I think we felt the need to address it just because Chris Hardwick is someone that is representative of the, like, geek, nerd, comic book, pop culture.
Yeah, over the
community.
Last few years, he's become nerd royalty.
Right. And I think that part of his shtick is sort of like, you can like all these things, being into all that
he's
stuff,
us.
and you don't have to be you don't have to be some weird creeper. And it's come to bear that
he is a weird creeper.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, I didn't see how fast AMC moved on this. He hosts Talking Dead for both The Walking Dead and Fear the Walking Dead on AMC. He had his own talk show, Talking with Chris Hardwick, on AMC, and he was going to host a couple Comic-Con panels in the next couple months for them. And like after the initial lightning strike of the article coming out and a bunch of posts on Friday following all that up, I didn't see anything from AMC, but then I went to watch Talking with Chris Hardwick that I had recorded from Sunday night, and they had already, you know, they put a message up saying, you know, Talking with Chris Hardwick won't be aired tonight. And then it went into an episode of Ride with Norman Reedus.
Yeah, it seems like that they have, you know, cut some ties with him. Doesn't seem, I can't tell from the article if he's been officially fired, but it doesn't seem like the episodes of season 2 of Talking are going to air anytime soon. So, It's pretty swift.
It's a tough spot for the network to be in. And yeah, you know, I roll my eyes, boo-hoo, big network problems. But, you know, maybe Chris Hardwick shouldn't lose his career over this. But, and maybe, like, it could be. I mean, while I believe everything in that essay, like, there could be some stretches of the truth here and there. Like, he could have a side that balances some of the other stuff. But
or
in this current...
Even if it's all 100% true, he's essentially just a fucking prick. And should you lose your career for being an asshole?
I mean, Christian Bale threw a fucking phone at a guy.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of people...
Or is that Russell Crowe?
Russell Crowe
threw a phone at a guy.
Christian Bale
he's doing
just
fine.
Yelled at a lighting guy, I think.
I mean,
in spectacular fashion.
Mel Gibson went on a fucking
so
Nazi tirade.
Well, Nazis are
and he's fine.
He was at the Oscars this year. He was nominated for Best Director.
So,
or last year, whatever it was.
Yeah, like, so what's the, I mean.
I don't know.
What is like, Chris Hardwick low tier enough that they can just bump him? Like, doesn't he have a say? Shouldn't we be able to hear, like, both sides of something like this? I think, you know, in a case like the Bill Cosby stuff, the Harvey Weinstein stuff, yeah, that's pretty definitive. You know, you're out. But this seems like it could be some he said, she said, where, like, I would like to get an essay from Chris Hardwick, like, getting his side of things.
I think what people had a problem with was his initial reaction was to come out and completely deny everything, and just say, oh, she's lying, blah, 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 blah. Who knows, but I don't know. It seems like there are some seeds of the truth in what she had to say.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't date Chris Hardwick.
No.
He doesn't have good enough lips.
Yeah, you know what? Thin-lipped. Very thin-lipped.
I don't know. I think his lips are okay.
Yeah, I think his lips are okay.
I know it doesn't have that turtle kind of like point in the front that I know you don't like on thin lips.
Oh, I definitely don't like that.
So,
but you know, if he's gonna make me take down, you know, pictures
all your
of
male friend
female
pictures.
Friends, or I guess maybe I guess it would be male friend pictures. Yeah, like he probably wouldn't let me do this podcast.
No, he wouldn't, because you're hanging out with a couple other guys. No, he would want to do this podcast with us.
I would think so. Well, he might not have a choice now.
Yeah. You know what? Yeah, who knows? Maybe.
Yeah, it was. It's so fast, and like he was doing everything. He was on that giant Plinko game show on like NBC or something.
Yeah,
The Wall.
Yeah,
man,
I'll do it.
It's a hard life out there. It's a good thing we are such low end celebrities.
We bow to no pressure on our sponsors, because guess what? There are no sponsors.
Right.
Except for the people that buy our TeePublic shirts.
I also guess it benefits us that none of us are such horrible people.
Speak for yourself.
Well, yeah, Matt's been awfully quiet over here, so this is all probably all hitting a little close to home for him.
While we transition and go into some what you've been doing, Matt, since you've been so quiet, what you been doing?
I read some Valiant comics recently. Valiant has a big summer crossover called Harbinger Wars 2. I guess they did a Harbinger Wars 1 like 2 years ago, something like that. And it crossed over Bloodshot and the Harbinger comic book. And I didn't read that one, actually, but I know that this one has Bloodshot, and the characters, they're kind of like Valiant's version of mutants. They're called Psiots, P-S-I-O-T-S?
That sounds right.
Okay. And basically, there's kind of like the Professor X / Magneto of this universe.
Isn't Harbinger a Valiant character?
No, it's like a team.
Okay.
But there's this woman named Livewire, and what she is able to do
Great
is basically
Motley Crue song.
Yeah, that's pretty good. What she can do is she can control technology like electricity, and she can. Like, I would be able to read the texts on your phone right now or look at the pictures just using my mind. Like, she can just tap in mentally.
If you could look at the pictures on Paul's phone, I'm sure your mind would short out.
Your dick would short out.
Dick malfunction, man.
So, in this, she has, three students that are starting to learn about their powers, and she's trying to protect them. And the U.S. government, I guess, decides they're going to go and kill these people. I don't know if it's the U.S. government directly or if they're working with another agency or whatever. But they decide they're going to go and kill these
Is it ice?
What?
It's Ice Cube.
They're going to kill these psyots. And she kind of like flips out. And what she does is she creates a blackout in the entire United States. And basically a few of like the regular Valiant heroes are like, you can't do that. So they step in and basically try to reason with her. But she's aligned herself with Bloodshot, who is a character that has all these little electric, they're called nanites, running through his blood.
Has he always had the nanites? Is this a newer thing?
Well, it certainly is a thing since it came back, but I thought he always did because he always had that healing ability.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
And I guess that's what helps rebuild his body because like he can take a beating just like Wolverine or Deadpool can, basically.
Yeah.
So I guess she kind of has brainwashed him, I think. I'm not sure. But
the downside to nanites.
Right.
Susceptible to brainwashing and
by
mind
people,
control.
Right, that can control electricity. So Ninjak, one of the main Valiant heroes, and Exo Manowar are both like trying to get this woman to basically like come to her senses and, you know, turn the lights back on. And because the country is going to devolve into the Stone Age quickly. Like, could you imagine if you had like a week long blackout in the whole country? Like, what the amount?
When was the last time that the power went off at your house?
I feel like it goes off every once in a while.
Yeah.
Like when maybe it during goes a off storm.
When it goes off for us, it is very traumatic. Like I get, because you think about all the things that you rely on power to do. And I know it sounds dumb and you should really, but no, everything that you do is connected to some object that has electricity running through it. And it's like after a couple of hours of not having electricity, it really starts to wear on you and you can't function in the normal way that you do. So I can only imagine living in this hellscape of a Valiant universe,
right?
With this live wire terrorist taking away my
right
PlayStation network.
So in the comic book, Ninjak basically gives her an ultimatum, like you got 24 hours to turn the lights back on or we're going to have some problems. And, you know, she's not really afraid of him or anybody else. I mean, she...
Because Ninjak's just a ninja, right?
Right, yeah.
They're Batman.
Yeah, right. But even Exo Manowar went to talk to her, and she basically said...
And he's kind of their Superman, right?
Yeah, kind of. He's sort of...
Manowar is kind of their Iron Man.
Sort of a mix. I would say he's a bit of a hybrid of the characters.
He's got the tech suit, but he's got the Boy Scout nature.
Right, like Bloodshot's kind of like...
from, he's a barbarian, too, right?
Exo Manowar?
More or less, yeah.
Yeah. He is.
He's from like ancient times. I don't know, ancient, but not. Yeah, was it BC?
I thought it was BC.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And he was a warrior
according
back then.
According to Exo Manowar number 0 with the foil stamp cover.
I'm sorry, Paul. Do you need to watch some videos on your phone?
What do you got there? What
all good, buddy.
Are you going to share with the group?
There's a Pittsburgh Penguin video.
Oh, okay. Cool.
I thought it was just going to be a silent GIF. It wasn't. It's a full audio video. Sorry about that, boys.
Back to Exo Manowar.
Right. So Exo Manowar was a soldier during ancient times, and I can't remember. I think the aliens like came down to Earth during like a battle or something, and he ended up on the ship, and it goes off into space. And while he's sort of sneaking around the spaceship, he comes across the suit, basically, and the suit essentially saves his life. And then they sort of meld, I think. I can't really remember all the details. I remember reading it and thinking it was very cool. It was written by Robert Vendetti, and I know you're a big Robert Vendetti fan.
We've had our ups and downs.
Well, let me tell you this. From I've heard
that old number from 0
more than,
from like the 90s.
Number 1 from the relaunch of Valiant back in 2011.
Oh, I'm thinking of the one. Joe Quesada did the art for this one.
That's Bart Sears, isn't it?
No, it's not.
Oh, okay. On the cover.
It's not.
No, okay.
No,
I thought Bart Sears drew XO.
He may have drawn the proper series, but not this the zero issue. But yeah, like he was captured by aliens and then got his little Iron Man suit and all that. So
looks good.
It's pretty slick.
I mean, I gotta give it up to Valiant, like on character design between like their main ones. I feel like Ninjak, XO, and Bloodshot all have such good, distinct, solid looks,
and they're recognized. They kind of borrow from recognizable heroes from the Marvel and DC universes. Bloodshot kind of looks like a Punisher, sort of.
Yeah.
XO Man of War to me has an Iron Man aesthetic to him.
Yeah,
but it's definitely kind of flipped and changed for their universe. But definitely great designs.
And so, anyway, really good first issue. Actually, there was the they call it the prelude issue, which told the story of the Psyots a little bit more. And I think at the very end of it, that's when Livewire turns the lights off.
Yeah.
And then the first issue is basically the fallout, and satellites start raining down from the sky, and XO's trying to, like, you know, save the what few he can, and then Ninjak gets sent in. But cool stuff. I'm really looking forward to the next one. There's going to be 4 issues, and then you have the prelude and the epilogue issue. So short series. And
are there any other tie-in books that you have to buy, or can you buy the story open to close with just the Harbinger Wars 2 titled book?
I think it helps to have an understanding of who the characters are, at least a basic understanding.
Yeah.
It definitely helps to kind of be up to date on the current Valiant books. The thing about Valiant Comics is they only really solicit about 6 books a month. But they have a whole bunch of characters, but they'll basically do miniseries. They'll do, I don't know, 5 issues, 6 issues, 12 issues, but they don't go on and on indefinitely. And they'll basically put them on hiatus. And when they're on hiatus, then another book will take its place. But right now, I would say the most relevant tie-in book would be, there's a book called, and I think it's over already. I think it was like 4 issues, maybe only 3. Secret Weapons, and I think that features Livewire and some of the other Psyots. But anyway, I like it. I think it's cool. I think it's leaps and bounds better than anything that the big two are putting out these days. I just find it so refreshing and enjoyable. Just like just about everything from Valiant I've ever read. Paul, you used to refer to me as Image Matt. I think it's time. I think it's officially time.
Yeah.
To change
Valiant
that
Matt.
Moniker. Yeah.
I don't know, man. Your Image roots are so deep.
They are.
You still get Savage Dragon.
I don't know why, but yeah, I do.
You've still got some big ties to Todd McFarlane, founder of Image.
Yeah, one of them.
You know, you've got a...
You've got an original commission
from Rob Liefeld.
I do. If you had to pinpoint the guy, the original founder of Image Comics, do you know who it is?
Who is it? Is it like Will Sportacio or something?
No.
Who is it?
It's Rob Liefeld.
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah, he was the one. He was the first one to start the revolution. And I think the second guy that he brought in was McFarlane.
Look at the light in your eyes right now talking about this. There's no way you're fucking Valiant Matt. Get the fuck out of here, Image Matt. You lit up.
Hey, man, I'm just saying, I do not enjoy comic books as much as I enjoy Valiant.
Yeah,
comic
your comic lore is steeped in Image history, but yeah, currently you're a Valiant guy. I don't even know what you get from Image right now. Anything?
I get Savage Dragon and Spawn.
Yeah, but you just kind of get those. You get Valiant books because you like them.
Yeah.
And you didn't read Man of Steel 2?
Not yet, no.
I read Man of Steel 2 and 3.
I have 2 and 3.
They're,
without spoiling, continue without spoiling.
Oh, no. What was your question?
Did you like them?
Yeah. Yeah, I like them. I like them both. I think Rogelzar is a stupid character. I think he's so fucking dumb.
Did you get answers that the first issue presented?
No, not yet. Okay. I keep waiting. And Bendis may drag this out. If you didn't listen to our Comic Book Pit episode, we talked extensively about Brian Bendis's first Man of Steel issue. And at the end, there is a question.
Are you like close with him? You don't say the Michael anymore?
Brian Michael Bendis? I just didn't feel like saying those two extra syllables. At the end of the book, something happens to Lois and John Kent. We don't know what. The way the book's set up, like Clark's alone by himself, back to work at the planet. Lois isn't around. John, their son, isn't around, and we don't really know what happened. There was a bit of a debate between the three of us as to what actually happened, and Brian Michael Bendis, Mr. Brian Michael Bendis, hasn't cleared that up. But it's cool. I like it. I'm itching a little bit for some more familiar characters, but I also know going in from a lot of his press when he signed up with DC that he was going to be very additive and add a lot of new things to the Superman mythology. So I'm not. At least I'm going and knowing that, so it's not a complete shock that where the fuck is Jimmy Olsen, who's been in the book. But yeah, I would recommend checking out Man of Steel.
Did you think that he was going to shake it up that bad and like shake loose Jimmy Olsen and Perry White, all those hangers-on, the Superman hangers-on?
No, because it was, the key word was additive, not subtractive, and Perry and Jimmy are tangential enough that they can be in the background without impacting the story a whole lot. But yeah, I'm not surprised we're getting a lot of the new Fire Marshal. There's a new the City Beat reporter. They introduce the pop culture reporter that's new. So he is bringing a lot of characters in that look like they're going to have a lot more to do with the greater story going forward. But the center of the mystery is where are Lois and John at, and who is Rogelzar? And there's still time. Like, I don't like the design of the character. I don't like big, bulky villains for Superman. I think the reverse David and Goliath is more interesting to me. Like, that's why I always like Lex. And that's why I always loved animated series Lex, because Superman never catches him. He never catches Lex. Lex is always a fucking step ahead of him. Superman knows he's bad. Lex knows he's bad. They both know Lex is doing bad shit, but Lex always gets away with it. And I like the
slippery white-collar criminal.
Yes, and I like that he's smart enough to like cover his tracks and work his way around, and it's kind of a battle of wits between the two of them. It's not just, you know, a 22-page punch fest, which is what Rogelzar is going to be, because he comes to Earth with the purpose of killing Kryptonians. Like, he doesn't come there with, you know, Brainiac comes with a plan. You know, Brainiac wants to, you know, he wants to take part of Earth and bottle it up and, you know, study it for knowledge. He doesn't come there to beat Superman up. When Jeff Johns and Gary Frank did their run on Action Comics, they set it up so fucking cool. Brainiac invades, and it's all these real skeletal robots, and they make this really creepy noise. There's a bunch of little spiders that like come down.
How do
you
know what they sound like? It's a comic book.
Because they do sound effects. They show the tick, tick, tick.
Oh, okay.
And it was just...
That does sound creepy.
Tick, 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 tick.
Did you read any of those issues? I know you're fucking making fun of me.
I'm totally making fun of you.
But it's so fucking cool because I can imagine it in my head. And it's all these real skeletal robots, these little spiders. And then you see Brainiac at the end. And he's just this real frail, like, you know, organism in a machine. And it was so fucking cool. And then an episode later, that wound up just being a facade, and he's this like big ripped guy that looks like when he's not taking over planets, he's hitting the gym and hitting those protein bars. And I was so disappointed because he was so creepy and omnipresent initially, and then it turns out he's just a guy that can punch Superman. And I thought that was such it was just such a letdown by like such a great story up to that point.
Yeah.
But you know, I'm sure there's more to Rogelzar's backstory. Bendis has set it up that we don't know all about what happened just yet. He was apparently working with Sardath and the Guardians of the Universe and, you know, some larger galactic beings. So there may be more, but right now he's coming to Earth like, I'm going to punch Superman to death. Come on. You can do better, Bendis.
I don't know if that quote is anywhere, but okay.
So that wasn't what I was going to be doing, but Ian, why don't you tell us what you've been doing?
So wait a second. So you just went and talked about something that you weren't doing? That was what you were doing.
No, Ian, what haven't I been doing?
I don't know.
I've done so much stuff, but I just went off on Man of Steel. So why don't you tell us, Ian, what you've been doing?
I've been listening to a book by Ben Westhoff called Original Gangstas, The Untold Story of Dr. Dre, Eazy-E, Ice Cube, Tupac, and the Birth of West Coast Hip Hop. I'm a child of 90s hip hop. I grew up on this time period of music.
What was the first song that really hooked you into this?
The first song, probably Nothing But a G Thing. Dr. Dre, Snoop Dogg, on The Chronic from 1993.
That's when you were like, fuck.
Yeah, some of the first albums that I ever had, I had to purchase under the guise of, I'm going to get something different, Mom. This Doggy Style tape, I don't know what the explicit content means, Mom. I don't know, but I bought it already, so I don't think that you can make me take it back.
Matt, do you know who any of these people are that we're talking about?
I mean, I've heard the names.
So, yeah, my formative years were based in buying a lot of gangster rap from the West Coast, and all these artists were sort of the first artists that I purchased their albums and their tapes and really, you know, kind of took as like my music.
They were another huge tentpole in the growth of hip hop and rap, because it was like, this was like the second wave after the 80s guys.
It was a big evolution from all the New York rap, which was kind of, it was party rap and sort of just like kind of harmless mic battling between different groups in different areas of New York, and other types
Run of, DMC rap.
Yeah, Run DMC, LL Cool J, Rakim, stuff like that. All the other places in the country really didn't have any kind of hip hop to really push up and boast as like something that could be taken seriously and throughout the country. But when NWA came out, which featured Ice Cube and Dr. Dre and Eazy-E, they really pushed the envelope with the stuff that they were saying and how they were portraying themselves, a real aggressive, sort of villainous.
Because this was also around the riots.
Yeah, the NWA started a couple of years before the riots, but then right whenever the riots hits, that's whenever that group
like
broke
gas on the fire.
It broke apart, and all the individual artists started making solo albums. And whenever that happened, that's whenever I started getting involved with it. So it was interesting to go back, and I've gone back and purchased those albums and listened to them in the past. But it's interesting to hear these stories. Ben Westhoff, the author of this book, spent 5 years compiling all the different stories and interviewing all the different sources for this book. And it's interesting to hear the growth and the initial impact of like Eazy just getting a bunch of drugs from his cousin. His cousin got, it was a drug dealer. He got murdered. Easy found a bunch of drugs and was like, oh, well, this is all profit. I'll sell all of this. And then I will take this money and I will buy studio time with all this money. And from just this little thing, it spawned this complete revolution of the way that the music of that rap is seen and was seen back then. The evolution also of it just being an art form to kind of spilling out and turning into actual gang warfare and ending with the death of Tupac and Notorious B.I.G. when it really all was just people pretending to be gangsters. And these guys mostly were just artists and just people that were pretending and putting on a character, basically. And it got so blown up and taken so seriously that everybody, that it just ended up with people getting murdered by real actual gangsters. So
who were the big East Coast names in 93?
Back then, like Wu-Tang Clan was a big name.
Were that early?
Yeah.
I didn't think they showed up till like 97.
No, Wu-Tang Clan was around in like 93, 94. Yeah. Biggie Smalls, Onyx was around back then.
Does Onyx count?
Onyx does count. Nas was someone that was around back then.
See, I thought Nas was way later too.
Nah, he was around.
When did Chronic come out?
Chronic came out in 1993.
Jeez, yeah. Like, it doesn't... Like, I feel like you know, Chronic, Snoop, Tupac stuff, that was early 90s. And then, like, when I think of, like, Onyx... 90s. Yeah, it is, but, like, when I think of, like, Nas and Onyx and Wu-Tang, I think, like, 97, 99. Like, they don't seem to have any crossover for me. Nate Dogg and Warren G have crossover for me.
Yeah. Well, because the West Coast stuff kind of took over and really was all throughout the culture and dominated what hip hop was for years and years and years. And all the New York rappers it took them a couple of years to kind of regain their footing and have a similar place at the table after being down for a couple of years because the style of rap was just so different from what they were doing that it took a while for them to like kind of get something that was similar but still authentic to New York.
Did you see Straight Outta Compton?
I did. And this book's a nice companion piece to that movie. The is movie like, kind of like rushes through a lot
of stuff.
Is this
in a weird way like the novelization?
You get
some extra scenes, you get some more depth, some more dialogue.
Yeah. This would be like sort of like the Timothy Zahn edition.
Where does Ice Cube fit into this?
Ice Cube was a founding member of NWA.
Okay.
Where does Ice-T fit into this?
Ice-T was separate and a little bit earlier than
East Coast.
West Coast. Yeah, West Coast. Ice-T was...
so used to seeing him fighting crime on the streets of New York and
yeah.
Law and Order.
Ironic that one of his most famous songs from his metal group, Body Count, was Cop Killer. And now he is more famous as playing a detective than anything else, I think.
I liked his character in... what was the movie that he was in with Judd Nelson?
Was it... Was it The Most Dangerous Game or no?
No,
or...
no. It was... Was it... Oh, man, I'm totally blanking on it.
I'm not totally sure.
He was a cop on that one, too.
In New Jack City?
New Jack City. That
oh,
was
that's
a good
right.
movie.
Yeah, New Jack City, yeah.
The movie that I remember around that era that you're talking about is Boys in the Hood. I feel like that was kind of equally culturally relevant at the time. It made headlines. I remember when it was in theaters, there'd be shootings in the theater because I don't know why, but there were. And but I remember what a big deal that movie was when it came out. And that was a very, very good movie from what I remember.
Yeah, Boys in the Hood's pretty good.
Cuba Gooding Jr.'s first breakout role.
And then after that,
Morse Chestnut is also in that movie.
Then after that, someone realized Cuba Gooding Jr. could play hockey and never casted him as a legitimate black man again.
He was in Jerry Maguire.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
He had two black roles.
He showed me the money. I mean, come on now. But Ice Cube made his first appearance in film in Boys in the Hood, and that kind of spiraled into him being a fairly lovable kind of like character now, where he's in
Are We There Yet
in the barbershop
like
movies,
family movies,
and he's a pitch man.
Well, he was on in Friday as well.
Yeah, that was a movie that he wrote because he sort of wanted to break away from the stereotype that he had created for himself as like the hardest dude out there and the most angry gangster that was ever on the face of the
did
planet.
Did you guys see Fist Fight?
I haven't, no.
I did.
Also, he's the police commissioner in the Jump Street movies.
Fist Fight's actually pretty good.
I'll have to check it out.
Yeah,
but Ice Cube was always my favorite because he, as a angry teenager, Ice Cube really spoke to that part of me. I know we all grow up and have that music that's that aggressive, angry, nobody understands you, fuck the world kind of stuff. And Ice Cube, for me, when I was 13, 14 years old, like, that was my guy. So it is a little weird to see him turn out to be the guy and, you know, Are We There Yet?
Well, I think he does a pretty good job in Fist Fight going back to the really threatening, scary. Like, there's no soft part of him in Fist Fight, even when the resolution comes at the end of the movie. Like, he's still the tough guy. He does a really... like, Fist Fight has some ups and downs. I think Charlie Day and Ice Cube are fucking awesome.
Good,
I think,
chemistry.
All of the bit players in that movie are garbage.
Yeah.
I don't totally disagree with that. That's actually a fair assessment.
I think you like it because Charlie Day would play you in McSauce in the movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what I've been doing. Original Gangstas by Ben Westhoff.
So if last question, if the West Coast movement was a big tentpole in the early 90s, what was the next big rap tentpole? Because I thought it would have been Wu-Tang in the late 90s, but I got
that
all wrong.
No, I mean, that was kind of happening simultaneous. The next big thing probably was the... At the same time, there was a Midwest and Southern rap revival. More
like Nelly?
Nelly in the Midwest, and then in the South, you had Outkast, Goody Mob, Ludacris, bands.
Is that
like,
close to Eminem years?
Yeah, and then like directly after that would be Eminem with the Midwest kind of revival of hip hop. So that's the next evolution in where it went after all the West Coast stuff. Is South and Midwest.
You know, it's interesting, Ian, that you brought up that book because of the time that it takes place in the early 90s and the fact that you're talking about an audiobook, because the thing that I've been doing is also audiobook related, but it's not quite as hard as the stuff you were talking about. Mine's video games. And I'm revisiting the audiobook Console Wars by Blake J. Harris. That came out in 2014, where he basically tells the story in a very narrative way, like with as if it's written like as a novel rather than like a bullet-pointed like fact sheet about the machinations of Sega trying to basically compete with Nintendo back in the early 90s. And having been a fan during those years, it's like it holds extra nostalgia for me because like I kind of understand, I remember a lot of what they talk about, and now I'm getting kind of a behind the scenes and a broader understanding of it. But
Did you read it first, and now you're re-listening to it?
Listening to it for the second time. It's comprehensive. It's long. It's over 20 hours, and I'm already 10 hours in. Like, I'll listen
20
to...
20 hours flies by pretty quick.
Fairly. I mean, I listen to it in my commutes. I listen to it a little bit at work if I don't have to, like, think. So basically, like, emails... can't do it then. But if it's like, oh, do some 2 hours of Photoshop, okay, cool. Mm-hmm. But I probably listened to it like 3 years ago, and like I kind of remember the broad strokes, but enough that it's fresh to revisit it and kind of go through it again. And I think it's masterfully read by the guy's name is Fred Berman. I've listened to other books that he's read. Coincidentally, one of my favorite books, Gil's All Fright Diner, he read that one too. And but I think this book is interesting if that's your generation, whether you were into video games or not, because there's so much relevance of that era that you can, they'll talk about in the book and you'll remember it. And I also think that it's interesting if you are a fan of like advertising and marketing and things like that.
Well, just the fact that the main character in the book, Tom Kalinske, who is the head of Sega America,
right.
He came from Mattel. He headed up Barbie and He-Man for a while. So it's all interconnected.
Like Tom Kalinske, whether you realize it or not, was very influential on your childhood, more than most individual people were in terms of the shit that you played with or, you know, the stuff that you were into. I mean, for me personally, gigantic He-Man and Sonic the Hedgehog fan, and he's kind of responsible. He didn't actually create Sonic the Hedgehog, but he helped shape him and mold him into the version that we have today. It's definitely told from the Sega point of view, but I think that it gives a lot of honest gives an honest look at Nintendo and doesn't completely short shrift them. They definitely get into the details about like their history as well. I mean, maybe there's two sides of the story here, but their business practices seem to align with everything else that I've ever read and understand about them. And they kind of had that monopoly on the market, and that's good for nobody. And Sega came in and basically changed the way video games were done. They came in and they said, okay, Nintendo, you can have the six-year-olds, but we're going to appeal to everybody else. And ever since then, video games were for teenagers and 20-year-olds and 50-year-olds. Like, they kind of were for everybody. And I think if Sega hadn't done that, if Tom Kalinske didn't change the way that shit was presented, I'm not sure it ever would have caught on to the degree that it did. And obviously, like, things like the Sony PlayStation kind of rolled out from that, but I think it was Sega initially that really made it happen. Otherwise, everybody would just be playing Mario and Zelda to this day.
If you want to hear the other side of this, or at least a shortened version, there's a companion book that's only 8 hours long. That's Super Mario, How Nintendo Conquered America, which is sort of a very brief, sort of truncated version of how, in the same time span, what Nintendo was up to, the history of Nintendo, and its history all the way up until the release of the Wii, I believe.
Oh, that's cool.
So yeah. That's something that, if you do like this recommendation by Matt, Console Wars, Super Mario, How Nintendo Conquered America.
Console Wars
is a good one, too.
I'm definitely going to have to check that out. But Console Wars only goes up to 96, 97, somewhere in there, which was like right when they announced the Sega Dream, or not the Dreamcast, the Saturn.
Yeah.
And apparently, like, what happened was there was a huge struggle between Sega of America and Sega of Japan. And Sega of America was the side that was reaping all the success. They were the ones that were strategizing and basically beating Nintendo at their own game. And Sega of Japan wasn't finding the same kind of traction. But Sega of America wanted to do the follow-up system their way. They wanted to, actually, this is kind of interesting. They wanted to align with Sony. They wanted to team up with Sony, and they were close to doing it, but Sega of Japan said, why would we do that? And then Sony went off and they made the PlayStation. And
with all the market research and development that they had already put in. They took all of that and made the PlayStation.
Right, right. Which started with Nintendo. They got first. Sony got snubbed by Nintendo, and then they got snubbed by Sega, and then they were like, "Well, I think we'll do our own thing." And then they came out with the PlayStation, and
seemed to work out.
On the same day that they announced the Saturn, this is how crazy shit was back then. They announced the Saturn at the big E3 press conference thing. And then they said, and Sega of Japan forced them to do this. And they said, oh, and by the way, it's available today. So people, like none of the retailers were ready for it because nobody knew it was coming. And it was just a complete disaster for Sega. And they also said it's going to cost $399. And at the time, video game consoles, you know, we're going from the Sega Genesis, which I think it launched at $199. And then it, you know, all the price cuts, and then it was $129.99. And then they come out with a $400 system. It's just craziness. And then on the same day, later in the day, when Sony did their press conference and announced the PlayStation, they said, oh, and we're going to charge $299. And it was at that moment that Kalinske was like, yeah, we just lost. It's over.
The real lesson of console wars is that Sega fought itself the whole way to the top, mm-hmm. and then back down to the bottom and into just being a publisher of video games instead of a maker of hardware.
Almost obscurity. I mean, they almost don't even exist anymore, which is as a longtime Sega fan, it's very difficult for me to, that's a tough pill to swallow, because I feel like they've got so many good IPs and original ideas and characters and things that they have absolutely wasted.
It's like being a Marvel fan for the last few years.
Well, at least we get to see him on the silver screen, whereas
Sega, they still exist.
Sonic, you can see Sonic race against Mario and some of their the Olympic games.
I preferred the days when they were like rivals, like the companies would snipe at each other, you know, because you either liked one or the other. I liked those days picking a side.
I like the old commercial where they showed, I think it was Super Mario World, and how slow it was.
Yep.
And then against how fast Sonic was.
Right.
Eating up those rings.
That was in the book, because that ad, basically they were like, we want to appeal to everybody. You know, do we want to show that it's not just for kids? So do we want like some, you know, early 20s pretty girl going into the shop to, you know, shop for video games? Or do we want like some Letterman high school jock walking in? Or do we want like some dude on a motorcycle? And they're like, well, what if we just do it from the point of view of you? So it's you walking in to the store and seeing the two video games side by side. And that's why it was done in the first person, because they wanted to appeal to everybody.
They really had some cutting edge dynamic marketing. And I think that in this book, it really is highlighted. That's one of the main reasons why it leapfrogged, I feel like they leapfrogged over Nintendo's relevance for at least a year.
They did for,
maybe not sales, but relevance.
Well, they did in sales, and they did in relevance. I would say Nintendo started getting aggressive and not just resting on their laurels a few years into the Super Nintendo life cycle, and then it started to become more of like an even battle. And I think that the Super Nintendo was a superior piece of hardware, and that started to show further into the life cycle. But Sega came out like they were ready to go the distance, and Nintendo like didn't take them seriously at all. So it's, you know, the company, the marketing firm, I forget what they were called. They were the ones that coined the phrase for Nike, just do it. Well, they were also the ones that came up with that Sega scream at the end of the Sega commercials.
How's that go?
I forget. You help me out.
Oh, man, I can't do it.
You were going to.
You were going to do it.
I thought about it.
Do it.
Paul, did you have a Sega back in the day, or were you a Super NES guy?
No, I prefer to embarrass myself accidentally.
Did you have a Sega, or were you a Super Nintendo guy?
I had them both. Like, there was no, Like all of this talk, like, it is foreign to me. Like, I have Matt's talking about the E3 and the sniping and all this infighting. I had a Super Nintendo, I had a Sega, I played Sonic, I played Super Mario World. They were both two video game systems in my living room. I mostly All's played fair. Super Nintendo
at household.
My buddy Steve's house. Like, yeah, there was no difference to me. They were both
like kids.
They were both
1A
and 1B. Yeah, they were talking in school, but it was never
it
like
was
there
Guns
was never
Roses
the division
Bon Jovi.
that you made it sound like. It was never you were either fan or one or the other. Like in the mean streets of the, you know, the urban Pittsburgh area, everyone liked everything. Like there was no division.
You got that?
And you always bitch at me for, you know, my sports nature of everything. It
because
has to be one
what,
or the other. But
that's
what this
do.
Guy's selling
no,
right just, over here tonight.
No, that's not. See, you're misrepresenting what he's talking about. He's explaining a book with the corporate culture, which were two corporations.
No, we can rewind the tape. He just said back in the 90s for fans, it was you were either a fan of one or the other.
Yeah,
see, I had them both too. So
yeah, they were the same. Like, I didn't think one was better than the other. One had
too,
better marketing, or one was pulling ahead.
One or
the underlying thing here, everybody, is that we were all spoiled kids, by the way.
Yeah, right. No, the only
thanks, Mom and Dad.
My only irritation with it was that I needed two different things. I couldn't just play everything on one thing.
Right, but I did feel a certain way about both of my consoles and which one had some of the, like, Sega for a long time had the better games. It just did for me. It had the games that I played more.
It always played the sports games better for some reason.
Yes.
I don't know 100% why.
100% agree.
Because Nintendo was the more powerful system, but yet they played better on Sega. I don't know. To this day, I don't understand that. But, like, for me, yeah, I eventually got both too. And here's the thing. So I bought the Sega Master System. That was like the one that came before the Genesis. I had saved up all summer. I had this little dog bank, plastic, like, pug bank that had like a felt coating on the outside of it. And I remember every coin I got, I would put in this thing. And by August, I was so proud of how heavy it was. I'd put it on the scale just to see how heavy my bank was. 2 pounds. I'd be like, oh my god, Mom, feel how heavy my bank is. And then the time came when I felt I had enough money to count out the money, and I dumped it all on the floor and I counted it up, and I think I had like $35 and
in pennies.
Yeah. And I think my mom at that point was like, well, we can go get the Sega and you can just put that toward it. And so, you know, not bad for like a 7-year-old. And we went to KB Toys and we got the Sega thing, and I was like pretty much a fan from then. And then same thing with the Genesis. I knew it was coming. I wanted it, and I knew I had to save up for it. So again, all summer I saved for it, and I got about halfway there. And my birthday is in October, and I got it for my birthday in October. And basically, I had to pay for about half of it, and my parents paid for the other half. And God, I wanted that so bad. You know why? Golden Axe. That was the game that I wanted.
Yeah, now that I think about it, I don't think I had a Super Nintendo. I think I just had Genesis. But yeah, I was over Steve's house so much, and we played so much of his Super Nintendo that it felt like I had Super Nintendo. Yeah. I was just as versed in Super Mario World as I was in anything on the Genesis. But once the first NHL game came out, everything else went out the window. Like, you know, that was probably the last time I played Street Fighter.
But anyway, it's a good book. It's long. We're just scratching the surface. If that's your era, then this book is, I think you'll find value in it. And it's well read. I feel like that's one of the most important aspects. So if you do check it out and you want to check out the audio, it's so worth it.
Anyone else have anything left to add? That's going to do it for us tonight. My name is Paul McGinty.
Ian Sharpley.
Matt Cassell.
And we'll see you next time.